For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Good evening and welcome. I had planned to speak this evening about the next case in the Book of Serenity koan collection in the series of talks on those that I'm doing. However, after the events of this weekend, I will speak on something else. I want to share my personal connection and responses to the shooting Saturday at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, where 11 people were killed and 6 wounded. My bar mitzvah was at the Tree of Life Synagogue. It was a few blocks from where I lived while growing up, from ages 6 to 17. So Saturday it was kind of surreal to see on television the temple where I went to Hebrew school and Sunday school with soldiers and SWAT teams massed in front. I've not lived in Pittsburgh since 1972. And I have not stayed in regular contact with anyone from there. My family, I don't have any family there now. But I was there a year ago, September, and enjoyed my 50th high school reunion. One of the 11 victims, Irving Younger, was a high school classmate of mine. It was a very large class. We were not close, but I recognized his name. Another victim, Dr. Jerry Rabinowitz, was an HIV specialist, a doctor who helped many with HIV. I want to say, with a few exceptions in our Sangha, we are mostly all first-generation Buddhists. We're Zen practitioners, but most of us still deeply conditioned by our Judeo-Christian roots. Not true for some people, but we're connected to different faiths through interfaith dialogue, and often our own internal dialogues between traditions, different traditions of spiritual practice. So a number of you have asked me about Buddhist-Christian interaction. So just as an example, I want to mention, I wrote to a few of you about him, Paul Gaffney, who's a Christian minister from the Disciples of Christ, who was also a Zen practitioner and board member at my Mountain Source Sangha group in the Bay Area before I moved to Chicago. Paul's going to be joining us for all of the Rohatsu Sesshin beginning of December. He'd taken classes with me on Dogen and Zen and other Buddhist topics at Graduate Theological Union, and later received lay ordination from me at Mountain Source. He also asked me to participate as a mentor in his Christian ministerial ordination. Paul became the Marin County homeless chaplain, spent a great many years on the streets of San Rafael and elsewhere in Marin as a dedicated minister to the homeless community there. He trained his successor, and he's now completing studies to train chaplains at the San Francisco Theological Seminary in San Anselmo. But I like Paul's definition of God, speaking as a Christian and a Buddhist, as a Buddhist Christian and a Christian minister. Paul says, "I experience God as the flow of energy in relationship between self and other. God is the movement that connects us all, the whole creation, now and forever." So this is a way to see our radical interconnectedness, and in a way to see all of these events, I think. All the mass shootings are horrible, from Parkland in Florida to Sandy Hook to all the terrible shootings every single day on the south side of Chicago. But somehow a personal connection intensifies the horror. So the Squirrel Hole neighborhood where I grew up has been much in the news with vigils. The shooter at Tree of Life was virulently anti-Semitic, but also he was very specifically anti-refugee. He was targeting a particular Jewish group that supports refugees, Hebrew Immigration Aid Society. Groups at Tree of Life Synagogue were supporting current refugees fleeing violence, including from Central America. And it's a liberal congregation. The rabbi has been speaking about gun control. Also last week, the person in Florida arrested for sending bombs to former Presidents Obama and Clinton, as well as a dozen other Democratic leaders, such as Senators Kamala Harris and Cory Booker, was a nationalist white supremacist who was virulently anti-black, anti-Semitic, and anti-refugee. Last week also, a white man in Kentucky unsuccessfully tried to break into an African-American church and then shot and murdered two black people in a nearby grocery store. So, our bodhisattva commitment, the expression of our sustained zazen practice, leads us to feel like we must work against hatred and for communication and understanding so difficult now. So I want to talk about refugees. All of us are descended from refugees or from immigrants seeking a better life. Of course, some Sangha members are descended from people forced here in slave ships or from Native Americans whose ancestors came much, much earlier across the Bering Straits. So the issue is the complexity of our intertangled, ancient, twisted collective karma. And how to respect all, including all these victims of hatred, and keeps going, but also those who have been manipulated into seeking scapegoats for their real fears and suffering. So how do we understand the people who are manipulated often by politicians into hatred? How do we include all of these, of all of this process, all of these beings with kindness, and still speak truth to power and join actions that stand strongly against hatred and harm? That's our great koan now. The current Central American refugees from Honduras and Guatemala and El Salvador, as well as Mid-Eastern refugees in Europe, are fleeing war and terrorism instigated and sustained by our government's policies. Recent reports are that 12,800 children remain in United States detention camps, that the policy of separation of children from their families at our southern border is continuing. So I think about how our taking refuge in Buddha is connected to the refugees from war, terrorism, and the effects of climate damage as well. Somehow I feel a kinship as a Dharma refugee with all of these refugees and immigrants. We take refuge in Buddha and Dharma and Sangha to return home to something deeper, to some deeper communion and interconnectedness, but also we find refuge from the horrors of the hatred, cruelty, and greed of the ordinary world in taking refuge in Buddha. And all these are being exacerbated in the time we're in now. So this is our taking refuge. For people here who take refuge with Soto Zen precepts, I also recommend Thich Nhat Hanh's version of the precepts in his Order of Interbeing. So especially relevant are the precepts not to kill. So Thich Nhat Hanh says, do not kill, do not let others kill. Find whatever means possible to protect life and prevent war. Also the precept to speak truth. Thich Nhat Hanh says, always speak truthfully and constructively. Have the courage to speak out about situations of injustice, even when doing so may threaten your own safety. So, again, this is a big koan. Our society is full of hatred and division. And it's hard to know what to do. But, you know, this event in Pittsburgh this weekend touched me personally. It happened right in the neighborhood where I grew up. I know the streets around there very well. I know that temple. And the issue really that motivated the gunman was refugees and keeping out the others, Hispanics, the so-called caravan of people from Central America trying to find safety. And, of course, we all, you know, there's this human habit of thinking of self and others and seeing some people, some beings, some as other and separate from us. So again, I feel this link between, as a Dharma refugee, taking refuge in, whether you formally do that ceremony of taking refuge or not, just by being here, sitting zazen, we are returning to somehow something deeper, to be upright and calm and responsive like Buddha, to hear the truth, to see the truth in our lives, and to refuge in sangha and community. So I had to talk about this tonight, and I'm interested in hearing any responses any of you have. And also, as Dharma refugees, I hope we might strongly speak out and act in whatever ways we can to support current refugees seeking sanctuary in our country. And then how do we work to oppose hatred? Hating those who hate, it doesn't work. How do we see again, the real fears and pain of those who are manipulated into hatred? How do we oppose that without hating them or hating what's happening? How do we open-heartedly act against hate? So just one little part of this is the reminder to please vote in the election coming up and vote against hatred, however you see that. So that's what I wanted to say. And I'm not sure what else to say, but I hope that some of you have some responses. So please feel free. Part of what Sangha is a chance to share perspectives and share viewpoints and share how we think and respond about our lives and the world. So, comments, questions, responses, please feel free. Ben.
Tell you thanks. I'm really sorry that that touched you so directly. I've been thinking a lot lately about resentment. A lot of research has shown that these particular kinds of shooters are motivated by a certain kind of white male resentment. And I think that we can see much more broadly in our politics in the U.S. and Brazil just elected a right-wing demagogue, most extreme right-wing politician in the hemisphere. And I think that the politics of resentment is really driving that too. And I've been thinking about how to understand it and how to understand it through the Dharma and how I see it popping up in my own cushion too. How I see it popping up in my own practice. And why it's so seductive and so powerful. And I think it sort of springs from this in sense of inadequacy, in sense of lack, you know, the personal or true.
Yes.
We all feel probably one way or another. And tied to this, I think it's only our dinner and money. If only those people weren't doing something to me. If only they weren't taking something from me. If only they weren't causing some kind of harm. And then in this really perverse way, it kind of circles back. And it that sense of lack gets sort of solidified by the sense of, you know, I am someone who has had something taken away. This sort of one subjectivity is based upon disliking other things, and one sense of fulfillment has been taken away by other people. And I know that that's a pattern that I see in my own practice all the time. And I know that's a pattern that I see in my own life. You know, I'd be happier if only my boss paid more attention to me, if only my colleagues weren't such jerks. You know, and we can see it in our practice too, you know, I'd be more comfortable if only I could move my leg or, you know. And I don't know if my practice has helped me. It's helped me identify it. It's helped me see why it's so powerful in emotion. It's helped me see when I get sucked into it too. And I think we're kind of challenged understand how this big interconnected world that we live in is really promoting people basing their senses of who they are on grievances that they have about others. And you know, ancient twisted karma is collective, so recognizing how that also manifests itself in us differently according to our different dharma positions. I don't know if that offers any easy answers, but that's sort of what I've been thinking about and pondering.
Thank you for that. I don't think there are any easy answers, but yeah, it's the collective karma. So, you know, people feel aggrieved, as you said, by, you know, those people coming from the South who are going to take our jobs or whatever, and really the issue is, well, I would say, in my opinion, the corporations and the, you know, the tax cuts for the very, very wealthy. And you know, it's a lot of people are having a really hard time. And on the surface, it looks like, oh yeah, the economy's booming. Anyway, this huge, ancient, twisted, collective karma, you know, of the history of slavery and racism and so forth, it's difficult. I think seeing it, as you said, is the first step, and being willing to speak about it and say no to hatred. But it's, as you say, it can come up in all of us. Other comments? Thank you, Ben. Other reflections or comments? Yes, Dennis, hi.
This came up with our yesterday. Sitting in the Dharma talk. And at the time I was thinking about it, and I found it really helpful to think that part of the answer is that a lot of the anger is an addiction. And the addiction is being purposely spread by pushers, like Fox News or Trump, in order to enhance their power. The addiction people respond to that. We see these rallies, for example. They love the feeling of excitement that comes from the feeling that if your anger is directed at a certain target, you know, that you become important, you know, you're a part of this collective anger, and they get more and more feeling that they want to be part of the great movement and so forth. But I really think it's helping me to think of it that way, not only to understand it, but also to try to feel some compassion for the people who have been manipulated by this situation.
Yeah.
It's being caused on purpose.
Yeah, there are people who are profiting off of the manipulation. That's true. Profiting hugely. And so, yeah, we want to feel compassion for the people being manipulated, but also we should feel compassion and sympathy for the victims.
Well, I don't find that difficult. Yeah. For the other people, it's been pretty hard.
Yeah. Yeah, so how do we respond to this, you know, see it from a wider perspective? Maybe that's part of what our practice allows us. Yes, Jen.
I was wondering how people responded to Trump's suggestion that it wouldn't have happened if there had been an armed guard at the door of the Tree of Life. Tree of Life Synagogue.
Well, I saw on television today some members of some people from Pittsburgh, officials and members of Jewish congregations in Pittsburgh, who were kind of irate at that. There were four policemen and SWAT team members who were very highly trained in using these weapons, who were wounded by the gunmen. So I don't know. Ben, did you have something?
I have a friend who's an Iraq war vet and a teacher, and now is doing a lot of work on handgun control activism, gun control activism, and he wrote a really fantastic blog post that I can see if he'll, I'm sure he'll share, and talks about all the training that he had to go through and how hard it was for him as a gunner in Iraq to learn how to respond appropriately while being fired at, and how traumatic it was for him the first few times that he was actively being shot at, and all the training and the emotional work that he had to do to learn how to respond in that situation, and the toll that it's taken on him for having been in a whole bunch of combat situations. And you know, the idea that it just a person with a gun could stop this is just, anyone who is a serious law enforcement officer who's been in combat will tell you that that's just false. Life doesn't work that way. It's just a misguided fantasy.
It reminds me of the man who was Abraham Lincoln's bodyguard, who was taking a day off the day that Lincoln was killed.
Mm.
And he thought, if I had been working that night, I would be dead now.
Anybody else?
who hasn't spoken yet, any?
Yes, Laura.
You're sorry that you had this personal experience. Sure, it's very hard. But one thing about it is it helps us understand it better. You know, there was a headline today that said 26 people were shot in Chicago on Sunday, the second highest number this year. And it doesn't seem real because the brains and minds just don't have a way to get to it. But if we have a personal connection through your story, it helps us be more understanding of the magnitude of the I don't know the right words for it, of the horror of it. So that's helpful, I think, for us in helping us not be so numb.
Yeah.
I think we get numb or we get scarred or whatever the right words are, but you just don't feel it after a while.
Yeah, and these 11 people and... and at this place that I know well, is nothing compared to actually to all of the shootings and murders right here in Chicago, and mostly on the South Side. So we're a little distant, separated from it, but it's an everyday occurrence. And for all the people affected personally by those shootings, and many people in Chicago affected by many, many of those shootings. And
the children and spouses, neighbors. One interesting thing in the accounts, the New York Times described the shooter as a ghost. A hungry ghost.
Yeah.
He said he was like a ghost.
An outsider, and we all sometimes feel like we're outside of, you know, whatever it is we think is inside. But what you said about numbness, I think that's a key thing. That it's hard not to become numb to. Well, yeah, we need to take care of our lives, and enjoy all the things that there are to enjoy in our lives. And yet, part of what this practice does is to sensitize us, to cut through the numbness. There's a way to not be numb, and to see all of this, the horror of every day in the South Side of Chicago, the horror of what happened in this very peaceful neighborhood I grew up in, and. And also see, you know, I don't know what, I don't want to diminish the horror, but also we need to live our lives. So how do we take care of, you know, I think our practice can give us the sense of openness to the horror and also appreciation for you know, the trees changing and poetry and beauty and caring. Did you have a comment? Yes, Jamie.
So overwhelming to get attached.
tried to really kind of grapple with that. And I'm thinking a lot about stepping back from that. And what is my attachment that it shouldn't be work? Like, why do I think that it should have order? Maybe it's okay that it's totally disordered. And that kind of stepping back from a lot of these disorganized things, which is, has so much to do with kind of media narratives and political
right.
narratives and all of these things that. And then there's the hate and the anger and all of those, and they're also enmeshed, but just kind of choosing to step back from that. And I think the gesture that you made of saying, I take refuge in the Buddha, these people are taking refuge somewhere too. I understand in some ways what it is, like the kind of gesture of taking refuge.
Yeah.
And kind of making the pieces that we can actually connect to instead of this organization, which is.
Interesting. Your word disorganization is interesting, and I'm thinking about synonyms. Not that that word doesn't get it, but also, you know, everything is so fragmented. There's a fragmentation in our world now, and there's a chaotic, this chaotic quality about day-to-day occurrences on the level of the news, but also, you know, in all of our lives, there's this sense of confusion and. And yeah, I think what you said, Jamie, about stepping back from that, giving up our sense of trying to control it so that everything will be normal, whatever that might be, or organized, or, you know, and to have a wider perspective to see that there's some, you know, in some ways this is human beings working out this collective, terrible frustration and anger and all of that pain and if we can just get through it somehow. But you know what that means, we don't know. So yeah, what you say about not being caught by the disorganization or thank you. Other reflections? Anyone who's someone? Yes, Ed, hi.
You know, I'm choosing to recognize that our country is in a political crisis.
Yes, sure.
And that will have the consequence of individual tragedy.
Yeah.
Murder, death, assassination, economic exploitation, victims of extremes. And it seems the aspirational values that this country is so capable of have been thrown down. And I want to think and go back to some of our great leaders, the void that we currently experience. Robert Kennedy.
Yes. Yes.
Martin Luther King, Birmingham Jail.
Yes.
And Abraham Lincoln, Gettysburg Address. These are men who gave voice to our greatest aspirations.
Yeah, you know, there's so much about our country that we can feel so negative about, and yet there's so much that's also beautiful. And yeah, I think the aspirational quality, as Dr. King said, the arc of the moral universe bending towards justice somehow, and it's a long, long road, but there's so much that's to appreciate. And at the same time, there's all this disorganization, there's all this chaos. It's really something. And I don't know that there's any answers. The practice is to find a way to be present and upright and some measure of calm and kindness in the middle of confusion and horror. And people come together after a tragedy like this, so that's happening in my old neighborhood with people coming together in vigils and expressing caring. Yes, Kirshen.
So that's interesting what you just said about people coming together and thinking about what is the mechanism for that. So last Wednesday I had this opportunity to think of everybody communicating before what happened in Pittsburgh, but it was during the pipe bomb scare before when it gets caught up. And so it was a little bit in the air. And so these are lovely conversations. You know, five different faiths represented. And they always, and they just bore me out from where I'm saying, isn't this great? We should do more of this. We really find that our values are so similar. But this time, at the end, people said, but the problem, it's great that we're talking to each other. The problem is most people don't have a faith at this point. Some small percentage of people actually attend the church or synagogue or whatever mosque. So what is the mechanism for the people coming together? What's the community structure? What's the... And the answer, the schools, the what, the...
I think there's a bit, yeah, well, our culture does not, one of the things we lack is sense of community, you know, in the sense of actually living communities like this, where people can talk together. What happened in Pittsburgh is actually students from my old high school, Alderdice High School, as a response that day after the shootings when there was an all clear, called for a vigil, and it was a huge gathering of people. And I think there's, you know, some, I don't know what, I don't know if we can name the vehicle or whatever, but there's some basic human caring and decency that Rebecca Solnit has written a whole book about what happens in tragedies. I forget the name of the book, but...
Paradise and Hell.
Paradise and Hell, right, thank you. Yeah, that, and she talks about many examples. She starts with the San Francisco fire back in the 19th century, but after 9/11, after Katrina, people respond and somehow come together. And so your question is good. How do we find a way to, you know, people who have faith communities, that's one vehicle, but... Yeah, which is also so poisonous. The shooter was had his community of haters on the internet. This is a disorganized time. So anyway, we're not going to find any answers to any of this, but I think it's. I mean, oh shucks, but I feel like, you know, I have to talk about this stuff sometimes, and this was personal for me, and I appreciate that we can talk together, listen together. Does anybody else have something you want to say before we close with the Bodhisattva?